Well, thank you very much, Bob. God bless the great state of Iowa. I'm thrilled to be here at Big River. And for all the Democratic politicians and folks in the media, see, these are people that are doing something called working. In Washington, that's very confusing to them. You know, I don't know how many of y'all saw this past week that a man was stopped climbing the fence at the White House. The Secret Service ran up to him and they said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, you got one more year." Well, then, and you may have missed it, this morning, a second person was stopped climbing the fence at the White House. The Secret Service ran up to them and said, "I'm sorry, Hillary, not yet." And not ever. And let me say something for the record. Hillary ain't gonna win Clinton County. Right. You know, all of us here, we're here because this country's in crisis. Amen. This is not a typical time in politics. We are bankrupting our kids and grandkids. Our constitutional rights are under assault each and every day. And America has receded from leadership in the world. And it's made the world a much more dangerous place. And yet I'm here this afternoon with a word of hope and encouragement and exhortation. We know how to fix these problems. And all across this country, people are waking up. You know, the nice thing about eternal truths, they're always true. Today, for the first time in history, a majority of Americans believe that our kids will have a worse life than we did. 65%. That has never been true in the history of this country until right now. And I am convinced the number one issue in 2016 is going to be reigniting the promise of America. Getting back to that fundamental commitment that our kids will have a better life than we did and their kids will have a better life than they did. How do we do that? Three simple things. Number one, we bring back jobs and growth and opportunity. The men and women here, we understand cause and effect. We understand every time the federal government goes down the road of out-of-control taxation and debt and regulation, the result is misery and stagnation and malaise. Amen. It doesn't work. And on the flip side, every time we pursue tax reform and regulatory reform, every time we get the federal government off the backs of the necks of small businesses, whether in the 1920s under Calvin Coolidge, or the 1960s under JFK, or the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, the result over and over and over again has been incredible economic growth and opportunity. Regulatory reform. You know, a few years back, I was out in West Texas. And I asked folks there, I said, "What's the difference between regulators and locusts?" I said, "Well, the thing is, you can't use pesticide on the regulators." And this old West Texas farmer, he leaned back, said, "Want to bet?" the most important regulatory reform is we need to repeal every word of Obamacare. We need common sense health care reform that makes health insurance personal and portable and affordable and keeps government from getting in between us and our doctors. And then there's tax reform. You know, every year we spend roughly $500 billion on tax compliance, on lawyers, on accountants, on paperwork. All of that is dead weight loss. As we like to say in Texas, it doesn't produce a single truck or tortilla. And I think the simplest and best tax reform is we should adopt a simple flat tax. Where every American can fill out his or her taxes on a postcard. And when we do that, we should abolish the IRS. There are about 90,000 employees at the IRS. We need to padlock that building. Take all 90,000 and put them down on our southern border. Now, to our friends in the media, I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But, you know, if you think about it, sir, imagine you traveled thousands of miles in the blazing sun. You're swimming across the Rio Grande. The first thing you see is 90,000 IRS agents. You'd turn around and go home too. The second key to turning this country around is we need to defend our constitutional rights. All of them. We need to defend the First Amendment, our free speech, and especially religious liberty. Yeah. That means that every serviceman and woman has the right to seek out and worship God with all of our hearts, minds, and souls, and their superior officer has nothing to say about it. That means that the Little Sisters of the Poor, a Catholic charity right now being persecuted by the Obama administration, will find in January 2017 that the case against them has been dismissed. Amen. We need to defend the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. And that includes protecting the rights of every serviceman and woman to keep and bear arms and protect themselves. Yeah. Which means the next time a jihadist shows up at a recruiting center in Chattanooga, he's going to encounter the business end of firearms wielded by a dozen Marines. We need to protect the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, our rights to privacy. How many of y'all have your cell phones? Let me ask you, please leave your cell phones on. I want to make sure President Obama hears every word we say today. We need to defend the Tenth Amendment. Or as President Obama calls it, the what? The fundamental protection that says the powers given to the not given to the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. That means there are a whole bunch of areas the federal government has no business sticking its nose, and chief among them is education. Yeah. And, woo, woo. And we need to repeal every word of Common Core. The third key to turning this country around is we need to restore America's leadership in the world. Instead of a president who boycotts Prime Minister Netanyahu, imagine America standing unapologetically with the nation of Israel. Imagine a commander-in-chief standing up and saying, "We will defeat radical Islamic terrorism." Yeah. Imagine a president willing to utter the words, "Radical Islamic terrorism." Imagine a president who makes unequivocally clear, under no circumstances will the nation of Iran, led by a theocratic Ayatollah who chants death to America, under no circumstances will Iran be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, some of y'all may be thinking, all of this makes sense to me. Basic common sense. Live within your means. Don't bankrupt our kids and grandkids. Follow the Constitution. But can it be done? Can we do it? You know, Scripture tells us there's nothing new under the sun. I think where we are today is very, very much like the late 1970s. I think the parallels between this administration and the Jimmy Carter administration are uncanny. The same failed economic policies, the same feckless and naive foreign policy. In fact, the very same countries, Russia and Iran, openly laughing at and mocking the President of the United States. So why is it that that analogy gives me so much hope and optimism? Because we know how that story ended. All across this country, millions of men and women rose up and became the Reagan Revolution. And it didn't come from Washington. Washington despised Ronald Reagan. By the way, if you see a candidate who Washington embraces, run and hide. It came from the American people, and it turned this country around. We went from misery and stagnation and malaise to booming economic growth, to millions lifted out of poverty into prosperity and the American dream. We went from our hostages languishing in Iran to winning the Cold War and tearing the Berlin Wall to the ground. Why am I so optimistic? Because the same thing is happening again today. You know, when we launched this campaign about 8 months ago, The New York Times promptly opined, Cruz cannot win because the Washington elites despise him. I kind of thought that was the whole point of the campaign. Listen, if you think things are going great in Washington, that we need to keep heading the same basic direction, just kind of fiddle around the edges, then I ain't your guy. On the other hand, if you think Washington is fundamentally broken, that there is a bipartisan corruption of career politicians in both parties who get in bed with the special interest and grow and grow and grow government, and we need to take power out of Washington and back to we the people. That is what this campaign is all about. Let me close with this. You know, for all of us here, freedom is not some abstract thing we read about in a school book. Freedom is real. It's personal. In our families. In our lives. For me, I think about my mom. My mom is Irish-Italian. Born in Wilmington, Delaware, working-class family. Her mom was the second youngest of 17 kids. They were Irish Catholic. They didn't know what else to do on a Saturday night. My mom became the first person in her family ever to go to college. Now, my grandfather, my mother's dad, was a difficult man. He was a drunk. And he didn't think women should be educated. And he definitely didn't think his daughter should be the first person in the family to go to college. Well, my mom stood up to her father. She went to Rice University, graduated in 1956 with a degree in math. And then she went to work at Shell as a computer programmer. Now, you want to talk about two industries, the oil and gas industry and computer science. Neither one of which were very welcoming to women, and she was at the intersection of them both. My mom used to tell me, she very deliberately didn't learn how to type. She said, look, it was the 1950s. I understood the world I was living in. She said, I didn't want to be walking down the hall and have some man stop me and say, sweetheart, would you type this for me? My mom wanted to be able to smile very, very sweetly and with a clean conscience say, I would love to help you out, but I don't know how to type. I guess you're going to have to use me as a computer programmer instead. You know, my mom turned 81 last week. She's been a best friend to me my whole life. She's a woman of incredible strength and character. She's an unbelievable grandmother to our two little girls, Caroline and Catherine. And then I think about my dad. My dad was born in Cuba, grew up in Cuba. As a kid, he fought in the Cuban Revolution. And he was thrown in prison and tortured as a teenager. My dad's told me about, he remembers lying on the floor of a Cuban jail cell. His nose was broken. His teeth had been shattered out of his mouth. He was covered in mud and blood and grime. And he was lying there, he remembers thinking, I don't have any kids. No family depends on me. It doesn't matter if I live or I die. But thankfully, God had different plans for my father. He was released from that jail, and he fled to America in 1957. When he came to this country, he was 18 years old. He couldn't speak a word of English. He had $100 sewn into his underwear. I actually don't advise carrying money in your underwear. And he got a job, his first job, washing dishes. Made 50 cents an hour. And he worked full time, 7 days a week. Paid his way through school. He and my mom together then started a small business. So I grew up as the son of two small business owners. Today, my dad is a pastor. He travels the country preaching the gospel. Now, my whole life, my dad has been my hero. But you know what I find most incredible about his story? How commonplace it is. Every one of us here, we have a story just like that in our backgrounds. Some of us, it's us. Others, it's our parents. Others, it's our great-great-great-grandparents. But what ties Americans together, each and every one of us, is we are the children of those who risked everything. And that, I'm convinced, is the fundamental DNA of what it means to be an American, to value liberty and opportunity above all else. That's why I'm so optimistic. When I was a kid, my dad used to say to me over and over again, when we faced oppression in Cuba, I had a place to flee to. If we lose our freedom here, where do we go? That is why all of us are here today. Because we are not prepared to go quietly into the night. We are not prepared to give up on our kids and grandkids. And if we stand together, if we fight for the Constitution, if we fight for the freedoms of this country, if we stand as one, as we the people, we can bring back and restore that last best hope for mankind, that shining city on a hill that is the United States of America. And with that, I'm happy to answer or dodge any question you like. Yes, sir.
Senator, thanks for coming. I have a question for you. Looking forward to 2016, who's the greatest enemy to this country and its people? ISIS or global warming? or the current president?
Well, that is a very, very good question. And you know what's amazing? There are at least two politicians, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, that would find that a difficult question to answer. Hillary might clearly say the current president. And Obama apparently thinks you're having an SUV in your driveway is more dangerous than a bunch of terrorists trying to blow up the world. These are dangerous times. We need a president who speaks the truth. You know, we've seen this terror attack in Paris. And yet the president stands up. He won't call it what it is. In fact, he insists The Islamic State is not Islamic. That's nutty. Look, if your high school senior came home and said, "Dad, the Islamic State isn't Islamic," you'd say, "All right, what were they serving at that party?" Like, I mean, that's... Al-Baghdadi has declared an Islamic caliphate to forcibly convert people to Islamism. And the president said, "Nope, not Islamic to me." You know, last I checked, the people who flew the planes into the World Trade Center were not a bunch of ticked off Presbyterians. And we've got to speak the truth. I'll tell you this, if I'm elected president, we will make unequivocally clear to the world, we will defeat radical Islamic terrorism. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Barack Obama gave a speech overseas where he said he doesn't believe in American leadership or America winning. I don't have time for that. Look, FDR and JFK and Ronald Reagan were all spinning in their graves at a president who says such a thing. I'll tell you my philosophy on radical Islamic terrorism. To borrow a phrase from Ronald Reagan in the Cold War, it's very simple. We win, they lose.
Senator Cruz, thank you for coming to Iowa. You mentioned the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. What is your, as president, would you support the Convention of States movement?
Well, Father, thank you. Thank you for that question. And when you talk about the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, they have been passions of mine my whole life, going back to when I was in college. Actually, my senior thesis under Robbie George was on the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. And so I always enjoy when you see politicians coming along suddenly discovering the Ninth or Tenth Amendments because they are under threat more than anything else. Look, the movement for a convention on states is growing stronger and stronger and stronger. So, I was just asked to explain what it is. Under the Constitution, under Article 5 of the Constitution, there's two ways to amend the Constitution. One is Congress can propose an amendment and it can be ratified by the states. That's the way we have ratified it. We have adopted 27 amendments doing that. The other is the states can call a convention of the states to propose amendments directly that then get sent to be ratified. We are seeing a growing and growing movement for a convention of the states, and the reason is simple. It's because Congress is ignoring the people. I think we have got to step up and pass serious amendments, and I'll tell you the two that I'd put at the very top are, number one, a balanced budget amendment. And number two, term limits. As president, I intend to fight to pass both of those amendments. And if you look historically at the role a convention of states has played, historically we have not had a convention of states because what's happened in the past is when the momentum keeps growing and growing and growing and growing, and when it gets really close, members of Congress get terrified, and they propose the amendment that's behind that. I'm happy to take those amendments however they come, whether they come from Congress or a convention on the states. We've got to reform how Washington does business, and I intend to fight for that to happen. Okay, great question. The question is, what happens when we repeal Obamacare? And let me take it in two pieces. I want to start with the first. I'm going to get to your question in a second, but let me answer a preceding question, which is, there's a real divide in this Republican primary about who actually is willing to take on Obamacare. Because here's the sad fact. There are an awful lot of politicians, including a lot of Republicans, who are largely resigned to Obamacare being a permanent feature of our economy. You know, it's interesting. If you go and look at the announcement speeches of all the different Republican presidential candidates, a whole bunch of them never even mentioned the word Obamacare. I'll tell you this right now. If you ain't willing to campaign on it each and every day, the alarm will go off. Okay, nicely done, Catherine. You timed that just perfectly. If you're not willing to campaign on it, I promise you, you're not going to do anything about it if you get elected president. So I want to start in the first place. I intend to make 2016 a referendum on repealing every word of Obamacare. Now let me get to your specific question. Once we repeal it, listen, everyone agrees we need health care reform. Nobody thinks we're done once you repeal Obamacare. I think health care reform needs to follow some basic principles. We should expand competition in the marketplace. We should empower patients and consumers. And we should keep government from getting in between us and our doctors. So let me give you three specific reforms that reflect those principles. Number one, we should allow people to purchase health insurance across state lines. That's illegal right now. If any one of you wanted to purchase health insurance in any state other than Iowa, it would be against the law. Now, what that would do is it would create a true 50-state national marketplace, which would drive down the cost and availability of low-cost, catastrophic health insurance. The biggest barrier to access, if you want people to get insurance, is cost. You ask people who don't have insurance, why don't you have it? They say, look, I can't afford it. If you want more access, you want more choices and lower costs. What does Obamacare do? Fewer choices and higher costs. The second specific reform is we should expand health savings accounts so people can save in a tax-advantaged way for more routine health care. And then the third specific reform. We should work to delink health insurance from employment. You know, a lot of people don't know the history of this, but it's an historical accident that most of us get our insurance from our job. It arose coming out of World War II, where we had wage and price controls in effect. And so employers couldn't attract new employees by offering higher wages. So they began offering perks. They began offering things like health insurance, and the tax laws incentivized that. But today, we don't live in the 1950s anymore. People don't tend to go work for one company for 40 years, retire, and get a gold watch. That's just not modern America. We are a mobile, transitory society. People move from industry to industry, from city to city, from state to state. And the problem is, if you or I lose our jobs, we don't lose our car insurance, or our house insurance, or our life insurance. There's no reason on earth you should lose your health insurance, and it's the worst one because that goes a long way to creating the problem of pre-existing conditions when someone loses their job, loses their coverage, and then can't get a new policy. So instead, what we need is health insurance that is personal and portable and affordable and goes with you from job to job to job. Thank you, sir.
My question is, I think everyone's mind. You have to get 535 elected officials to work with you. So my bottom line question is, how are you going to work with them when you've got tens of thousands of special interests and lobbyists continually pushing a process that I've seen not work for 40 years?
Look, it is a great question. His question was, how are you going to get Washington to work with you? How are you going to get 535 elected officials in Congress to work for you, particularly when you've got all the lobbyists and special interests in Washington, and it's been broken for a long time? I very much agree with your assessment of the problem. And, you know, this summer I wrote a book. It's called A Time for Truth. Right here, as it so happens. Right there. I spend a lot of time talking about what I call the Washington cartel. It's what you just talked about. It is career politicians in both parties who get in bed with the lobbyists and special interests and just keep growing government. What we've got to do is break the Washington cartel. Yeah. And if you look historically, how has that happened? That has happened one significant time in our lifetime. And it was 1980. It was Reagan. And the Reagan Revolution, you think about what happened. It came from the people. And let me step back for a second. How do we fix the real problems? Listen, if you listen to the Democrats, if you listen to the media, although I repeat myself, they want us to believe, number one, there's no way we can win. They want everyone here, abandon hope, all ye who enter here, give up. The country's lost. But number two, they want to believe, you know what, even if you do win, there's nothing a president can do to change what's going on. You're right, it's not true. And let's talk about three levers of presidential power and change. The first is executive power. Now, we all know Barack Obama has abused executive power. It has been the principal vehicle for his abusing his constitutional authority. But there's a silver lining to that. Everything done with executive power can be undone with executive power. So I have pledged, if I'm elected president on my first day in office, to rescind every single illegal and unconstitutional executive action. That's how you start breaking the Washington cartel. Look, Obama put in place illegal executive amnesty on day one. That will be undone with the stroke of a pen. Obama put in place an illegal exemption from Obamacare for members of Congress. On day one, that'll be gone with the stroke of a pen. Obama has used the Federal Department of Education to try to force the states to adopt Common Core. On day one, that'll be gone with the stroke of a pen. So that's executive power. Yeah, I'm going to need a lot of ink. The second avenue is foreign policy. Foreign policy is perhaps the thing that changes the fastest under a new president. It's worth remembering, in 1981, this same nation, Iran, released our hostages the day Ronald Reagan was sworn into office. That's the difference a strong commander-in-chief can make, and it's why I pledged on the first day in office to rip to shreds this catastrophic Iranian nuclear deal. So the third avenue is legislation. This goes right to the heart of your question. Now, legislation is difficult. Congress is not doing much of anything of consequence other than making the problem worse. I'm running on two big legislative initiatives. The first we talked about just a minute ago, repealing Obamacare. The second is adopting a simple flat tax and abolishing the IRS. Now, I'm not remotely naive or Pollyannish. Those are not easy. Could I do those today in the current Congress? Not a chance on earth. Why? Because those 10,000 lobbyists you talked about, the Washington cartel, you look at the tax code, for example. There are more words in the tax code than there are in the Bible, and every one of those carve-outs and loopholes is corporate welfare, it's a subsidy, it's an exemption, it's the power of Washington. The reason a flat tax scares them is it takes all the power out of Washington, brings it back to the people. So go back and look to 1980. 1980, Reagan didn't fly up to Washington, sit down with the old bulls in Congress and say, come on, guys, you got to stand for something. He knew that was hopeless. They weren't listening. There was nothing he could have said to convince them. Instead, he did what we're doing right now. He took the case to the people. He built a grassroots movement that became a tidal wave, the Reagan Revolution. And what it did is it changed the rules in Washington. How are we going to repeal Obamacare and adopt a flat tax? I intend to make 2016 a referendum and to come out of November 2016 with a mandate from the people to do both of those. There's an old joke that politics is Hollywood for ugly people. My wife says I resemble that remark. What Reagan understood is you change the incentives in Washington so a whole bunch of elected politicians say, holy cow, if I stand in the way of this grassroots tidal wave, they're going to throw me out of my job and I'm going to have to find an honest job for a living. Yeah. You know how many politicians look at this and say, I couldn't drive that. That's how you change Washington, is you do it with the power of the people, and that is right at the heart of this campaign. Yes, sir. We're going to do the last question here. Yes, sir.
Once you get rid of Common Core, what would you put into action after that?
It's a great question. What's your name? Logan. How old are you, Logan?
Turning 15 in January.
Well, happy birthday in January. What grade? Ninth grade. Big grade. All right, so the question was, once we get rid of Common Core, what do we put in its place? And let me say, listen, education is unbelievably important. You know, in my family, I spent a lot of time talking about the impact education had on my family, about my mom being the first person in her family ever go to college. I mean, it transformed her opportunities in a way that she could never have imagined. You know, I talked about my dad. You know, if you can imagine, you're getting ready to turn 15, my dad was 3 years older than you, 18. When he showed up in America, think for a minute about being 18 years old, showing up in a country where you don't know anybody. You can't speak the language. And you got nothing. I mean, that's a terrifying experience. It's an experience every one of our ancestors has been through. But you look at, in my dad's life, education, he went to the University of Texas. He learned English real fast because they were going to throw him out if he didn't learn English. And it transformed his opportunity. So education is incredibly important. And it is because of that that I think we should get the federal government entirely out of education. Yeah. I think we need to abolish the federal Department of Education. And the reason, Logan, is education decisions are too important for them to be decided by unelected bureaucrats in Washington. They should be at the state level, or even better, at the local level. Yeah. Yeah. Look, when it comes to the curriculum that we should be teaching our kids, the people of Iowa know a heck of a lot more about what y'all should be teaching your kids than does some bureaucrat in the bowels of a building in Washington. Let me give a concrete example. So in the past couple of weeks, we discovered that right now the Federal Department of Education is attacking a junior high, trying to force the junior high to let a little boy shower with the junior high girls. Now look, I'm the father of two daughters. That is nuts! Yeah. My daughter Catherine is 5. Catherine knows the difference between boys and girls. Now, let's say the local school board here decided to issue an order that boys get to shower with the junior high girls. You know what? Y'all would rise up and throw them out in a heartbeat. The school board did that. You say, what's wrong with you guys? Move to Berkeley. Get out of here. But the problem is when it's some bureaucrat in an interior office of the Department of Education in Washington, they don't care what you think or your parents think or anyone gathered here think. They're just going to decree their answer. And so education, we ought to have education that is vibrant, that has competition, that has choice, that has standards. And all of that should come from the local level with parents having direct control over it. Let me say a final thing to you, which is I want to thank you for coming out this afternoon, for spending some time visiting. If you agree with me that our country's in crisis, if you agree that we are standing at the edge of a precipice, that if we keep going down this road, we are going to lose the greatest country in the history of the world, then I want to ask each of you for 3 things. Number one, join us. Commit today. We have sign-up sheets everywhere. We have cards everywhere. Commit today to come out on February 1st and caucus for us here in Iowa. Now, February 1st, it's going to be a cold winter night. There's going to be snow on the ground. It's going to be easier to stay at home by the fireplace than head out to a local junior high gymnasium. But I ask you to come and stand and caucus with us. But the second thing I would ask is volunteer to lead. Volunteer to join the leadership team in your precinct, in your county. You know, all of y'all are going to be subjected to a gazillion horrible political commercials. I apologize for that. But you know what has more impact than all of those commercials? It's each of you talking to someone who knows and loves and respects you. Yep. Saying, listen, I know this guy. I've looked him in the eyes, and this election matters. Yes. Each of you picking up the phone and saying, all right, I'm going to call my sister. I'm going to call my son. I'm going to call my next door neighbor, or my business partner, or my college roommate. And I'm going to say, this election makes a difference to my kids and to your kids, and let's stand up and change what we're doing. Yep. And then the third thing I want to ask of each of you is that you pray. Between now and February, between now and November, that we spend each day on our knees asking God to continue this awakening that is sweeping this country. Amen. To continue waking people up. 2 Chronicles 7:14 tells us, if my people which are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray, He promises that God will hear our prayers and He will heal this land. The men and women gathered here today terrify Washington. And I got to tell you, liberty is never safer than when politicians are terrified. So thank you for being here, and God bless you.